your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Regular listeners, or even quasi-regular listeners to the show, know that I do a semi-regular feature called What's It Really Like to Be A? And we've done everything from psychiatrists to prostitutes, radicals to conservatives. What could be, in theory, more boring than what's it really like to be an engineer? And yet, because this is the pledge week, I had to dig very deep to find the one person who I can guarantee will keep this arid career juicy. He is the revered, and that word is often tossed around too much, but I think it's legitimate here, the revered New York Times bestselling author, most famously of Professor and the Madman, which is, an unlikely, fascinating topic. The book was about the creation of the Oxford Educational Dictionary. But the new book, just out, as in like 2 days ago, is The Perfectionists, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. Simon Winchester, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure indeed. I feel we need to address the race, class, gender issue up front. See, here in the Bay Area, we are quite focused on such issues. And in your book, every one of the key people behind each invention, from a clock that would actually tell decent time to the microchip on our iPhones that have 7 billion transistors on a chip the size of a fingernail, was a white male. Do you have a guess as to whether, if there had been less racism and sexism in those years gone by, would women and minorities likely have been proportionately represented?
Oh, I certainly think so. I mean, you've only got to look at people like Marie Curie, off the top of my head, who was so important in the early studies of radioactivity and X-rays and that sort of thing, Dorothy Hodgkin in crystallography, so many female scientists. So I have no doubt whatsoever, and indeed, of course, I don't talk much about DNA and Maurice Wilkins and Francis and Crick, but what was the name of the lady who was passed over for the Nobel Prize?
I know who you're talking about. There was a woman who was, arguably equally responsible
absolutely.
For the DNA,
so,
right?
Yes, I mean, the system was rigged, it was unfair. It would be different, I think, if this was done today, but we're talking about a history which begins in 1776 with a man called John Wilkinson, who undeniably was white, and it ends with the people who, well, it doesn't end, but it reaches its the close of the book anyway, with people that invented the laser interferometer observatories in Washington State in Louisiana, most of whom are white men. So it is what it is, but it needn't necessarily have been so.
Okay, so let us indeed start our trot through the centuries with said John Wilkinson. Bicycles are very popular here in the Bay Area, getting ever more popular. What in the world did John Wilkinson have to do with the bicycle?
Very little, as far as I know. What he had to do with was making the critical component of the first ever steam engine.
And I thought there was something about the way he bored the cannon,
yes,
which
indeed
was then used in making the first in making better bicycles. Perhaps I'm wrong.
No, I think, with great respect, I think you are a little misled. I hope it wasn't my book that misled you. No, he learned how to bore, and I don't want anyone to be bored by listening how to bore a straight hole in a piece of iron to make a cannon for the Royal Navy, and he used this technique to bore the first cylinders for James Watt's first steam engines. And the first delivery of what was, in effect, the first ever precise device ever made was the 4th of May, 1776. So 2 months exactly to the day before the founding of the United States of America. And he developed a way of making cylinders that were so perfectly fitted around the pistons of James Watt's steam engines. They had a tolerance between the outer wall of the piston and the inner wall of the cylinder of 1/10 of 1 inch, and this made the steam engines enormously efficient, and they didn't leak steam and sort of kind of thing that made them inefficient in the years before. And James Watt ordered 500 of them, and they were all exactly the same, because that's what precision is, doing the same thing over and over and over again. And those 500 initial steam engines essentially started the Industrial Revolution. So everything in the world changed overnight, thanks to this man, John Wilkinson.
Can we put to life the difficult... This was not a trivial task, because remember, millennia of history preceded that, and yet just preceding John Wilkinson, cannons misfired all the time because there was not sufficient precision. Can you put into words, can you make us feel what John Wilkinson did to create such a precise, and not just cannon, but again, piston housing, that it would not leak steam?
Essentially, what had happened before is that, in the case of the cannon, they were cast out of molten iron, and they were full of weaknesses, and, I mean, cast iron is a very fragile material, and when you put an explosive like gunpowder in it, if it's got any sort of infelicities in its making, sort of air bubbles and so forth, it'll blow up. Well, similarly with the cylinders that James Watt made initially before he met John Wilkinson. A cylinder was made by taking a sheet of iron and banging it with hammers until it curved and formed a circle, and then welding the circle together and using that as a cylinder, but that was full of bumps and dings and bends, and both things either were weak or leaked steam. What he did was he took a big chunk of solid iron and took a drill, very powerful drill, and mounting it on a very heavy, essentially a railway track, absolutely perfectly flat, and turning the drill as fast as he could, moving it into the face of the iron, drilling a hole that was the same diameter all the way through, and it was straight and didn't deviate, and the walls of the cylinder were thick enough and the same thickness throughout that there was no weakness, and that was the secret. He did this time and again and achieved precision. The precision between the outer wall of the piston and the inner wall of the cylinder was the thickness of an English shilling, 0.1 of an inch. So that was precision in 1776. It's a great deal more precise today, but that was the beginning of the story.
Dear listeners, pictures even now 300 years later. Somebody gave you, say, I'll give you $1 million. If you can take this very big drill bit, and you can take this very big cylinder of solid steel, and why would you mind drilling a hole in it that's precise? Think that in 1712 or whatever it was, that a man was able to do, a person was able to do this. It's quite a miracle. And lest we be seen as too militaristic here, the next person you talk about at great length is a guy who is key to developing the screw, Henry Maudslay. You want to tell us about him and the screw?
Yes, indeed. I mean, Henry Maudslay, it's so complicated. Well, let me just give an example. The Industrial Revolution has started, thanks to Watt and Wilkinson. So factories are being created. People are making fortunes. These people live in cities, because up to that point, in the early part of the 19th century, the closing part of the 18th century, the rich people in Britain tended to live in the country. They lived in big mansions, in castles, and they had hedges and they had fences that protected them, and they had servants as well.
Masterpiece theater kind of thing.
Exactly. They protected them from the riffraff outside. But all of a sudden, fortunes were being made by people who chose to live in cities which were rapidly developing, Liverpool, Manchester, London, Birmingham. And this meant that rich people were living in close proximity to people who had much less money. So the rich were coeval, if you like, with the poor. And the sociological consequence of that was envy, and envy begets crime. And so there was a lot of burglary in the early part of the 19th century. To prevent burglary or to limit it, people who lived in cities now had to do something they'd never had to do before: build thick, solid front doors and secure them with very sophisticated, unpickable locks. And a man called Joseph Brammer learned how to make locks very precisely and very beautifully, helped by a young apprentice named Henry Maudslay, who was a ferociously intelligent man and a brilliant engineer, who, as you say, went on to make perfectly flat surfaces, went on to make early screws, who went on to make micrometers, one of them being so accurate it could measure up to 1/1,000,000th of an inch. And it was so accurate it was called the Lord Chancellor, because no one would dare argue with the Lord Chancellor. So these people, because of this social necessity for locks, created a new type of precision device. The particular lock that Brahma first made, he was so convinced it could never be picked that he put it on a velvet pillow in the bow window of his workshop at 124 Piccadilly in 1790 and said, anyone that can pick this lock without destroying it, I'll give 200 guineas to. It wasn't picked until 1851, which was 61 years later. It was picked by an American called Charles Hall, who picked it in... It took him 50 hours to pick it. Mm-hmm. He was given the 200 guineas, and the company said, well, quite honestly, it shows what a brilliant lock this is, because it would take a burglar 50 hours to break it, so effectively your house will be secure. But he, Mr. Hall, brought over a lock to London, which he said is far better than the one made by Bramah, and challenged anyone to pick it. It was called a para-utoptic lock. It was picked in 15 minutes by one man with a piece of wood, and that man's name was Linus Yale. So the Yale lock was born. So all of these early precise instruments were born, first of all, out of a military need with the cannons, and then out of a security need with locks.
And when you think about, though, again, let's project forward, let's thrust forward 300 years. Dear listeners, is there one of you, unless you're a machinist, who even with modern machinery could make a screw, let alone one with such precision that it would match a bolt, that it would match that would match a nut, that could be done, can be bought for pennies, and where that they would be uniquely like each other, so that if you wanted a particular, if you wanted 10 of a particular kind, the threads would be precise. These
and
are
all
miracles.
The same. I mean, the crucial thing is interchangeable parts. That's the mantra we must remember, because everything about making, whether it's screws that you're talking about or the parts of a flintlock gun or the motor car, everything that goes into it has to be exactly the same. Otherwise, the producing them in large numbers becomes impossible. So hand in hand with the doctrine of precision is the manufacture of interchangeable parts, which America, uniquely in the world, in the 19th century, was very, very good at. And that doctrine of making interchangeable parts was at the heart of making the juggernaut, the industrial juggernaut that America went on to become.
Indeed. Lest I be too guilty of talking too much about screwing, but another of your heroes, Joseph
Whitman. And then bolting, of course.
Yeah, and bolting, right. We sometimes go together. Joseph Whitworth, you wrote, and this is a quote from your book, you wrote until about the late 1860s, 70s, whatever, quote, each screw, nut and bolt was unique,
yeah,
and the chance that any 1/10 of an inch screw would fit a 1/10 of an inch bolt was, quote, slender at best. Can you, again, bring to life how that level of precision was brought to occur?
Yes, I mean, he made a lathe with very, very specific dimensions to it, and a blade with very, very specific dimensions, and would turn the piece of metal against that blade at a very certain speed, at a very certain angle, and do that time and again without allowing anything to make the blade and to deviate in any way from the angle that he set at the beginning. That's the crucial thing, to make a machine tool which is so sturdy, so heavy, that it won't change, in the specific case, the angle of the blade such that the angle of the screw varies at all. And he was so good at it, was Mr. Whitworth, that to this day, in 2018, the measurement of screws and the pitch of screws is given, the units are called BSW, British Standard Whitworth Screws. So that's nearly two centuries worth of homage to this man, who looked like a baboon. He was extremely ugly, but nonetheless a brilliant precision engineer.
Well, I'm speaking with a brilliant, what do you call him, journalist, best-selling writer, whatever. Those of you who may have first heard of him in Professor and the Madman, his book, he's written about 10, including Krakatoa, another book about the big turn of the century, the volcano and geology. But his new book just out is, and his is Simon Winchester, The Perfectionists, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. And this is the time, only this is the only hour for the next 6 months that I must, my dear listeners, ask you to come to pay, as I think it's fair to say, your fair share if you like Work with Marty Nemco. And I've been moved to this new, better time only recently, so you may be relatively new to the show. But if you like it, you know, either my interviews or, you know, what I do so often on the show is I provide a service. I try to provide what I call workovers, where people call in with their work problem and I help them really quite expeditiously come up with a practical plan. If you like either of those, you like Work with Marty Nemco, this is your only time when you can show your support for the show. And we have inducements, of course. And inducement one is unique. I, in preparation for the show, have read this book, The Perfectionist by Simon Winchester, cover to cover literally. And as evidence thereof, I have copious notes throughout the book. Now, why anybody be foolish enough to want to pledge $150 to KALW to get to read my hieroglyphics or seismographic tracings, but to get a pre-publication copy of The Perfectionists, along with my scribbles, $150, all you need to do is call 1-800-525-9917. And the good feeling of being a member of the community called KALW, local public radio here in San Francisco, 1-800-525-9917. And if that's not enough, for a lower price, because I am not worth $150, I'm barely worth $120, but I have also written 10 books. My latest is The Best of Marty Nemco, third edition. It's the best 86 of my, would you believe, 3,000 articles for your work life, your personal life, and making a difference in the world. If you'd like an autographed copy of that, you can also call 1-800-525-9917 for $120. You get the good feeling of being a member at KALW. They give you a whole kind of member package, and you get a signed copy of The Best of Marty Nemco. We here at KALW like to keep these breaks short, so I will stop, and let's get back to what really counts is my talking to my dear guest, Simon Winchester, the author of The Perfectionist, about what it's really like to be an engineer. Let us turn to... let's turn to people. In your book, you quoted a manager at a manufacturing plant that had just added some automation in an automatic lathe or automatic manufacturing, and he said, you're quoting, "Our people are fantastically skilled, but they're human, and no human is going to produce the same quality of work at the end of the shift as the beginning." You then write, "Precision engineering now does appear to have reached some kind of limit, where the presence of humans can on occasion be more of a drawback than a boon. As the investigation of the Qantas Airways jet engine failure, as well as the Hubble telescope debacle, amply illustrates," end quote. Tell me the Qantas story.
Qantas Flight 32 in, I think it was November or December 2010, was taking off from Singapore Airport for a routine seven-hour flight down to Sydney. It was an Airbus A380, which is one of those gigantic double-decker aircraft. It had 459 passengers on board, I think, and in the cockpit, mercifully for what happened, five highly experienced crew members. It took off full power with four Trent 900 Rolls-Royce engines revving at full rate to bring this monster up to the normal cruising altitude. And as it was passing through 7,000 feet above Indonesia, because when you leave Singaporean airspace, you almost immediately go into Indonesia, there was a massive explosion from the port wing, and people, horrified, look out of the window and saw that the inboard engine had exploded, and it was full of holes, and the wing was full of holes, and fuel was pouring out, and it turned out all the electronics, the avionics, the hydraulics had all been smashed, and the plane became dangerously nearly unflyable. Well, the very competent Qantas crew kept the plane level at 7,000 feet and turned around gently and dumped as much of the fuel as they possibly could and alerted the emergency services, went back to Singapore and landed it with all sorts of problems. The brakes didn't work properly, and so all the tires burst and the steel wheels were white hot before the thing actually came to a halt 300 feet shy of the end of the runway. They couldn't stop the outboard engine because all the controls had been broken by the shrapnel coming from the number two engine. They had a devil of a time stopping the fuel gushing out and igniting on the white-hot brake shoeless, tireless wheels, But mercifully, after about 2.5 hours, with all the firefighters on the ground doing the best they could, they put out the fire, stopped the engine, and a relieved 459 passengers got out of the plane, and no one was injured. So they then did a big investigation into what caused what is called an uncontained rotor failure, which is very similar to what happened about 3 weeks ago to that Southwest Airlines flight going from LaGuardia to Dallas, I think it was. What they found was that in the very innards of this engine, this Rolls-Royce engine, was a tiny pipe about the diameter of a drinking straw called an oil feed stub pipe. And the purpose of this was to provide lubrication to one of the rotors in the high-pressure turbine chamber of the engine, a chamber of the engine where all the metal pieces are operating in a ferociously hot environment. Heat greater, the temperature greater than the melting point of the rotor and the blades. It's incredible how they actually keep them cool is a story in and of itself. But anyway, what had happened, it turns out, because every part of the plane is always monitored electronically, this little pipe had been incorrectly machined by an engineer and his machine in Hucknall in northern England about 2 years before, such that one of the walls of this tiny little pipe was 1/10,000th of a millimeter too thin.
Wow.
And the plane, it turns out, had taken off from Los Angeles on the previous day from a short runway. It was a very, very high-powered, very sort of difficult takeoff. And that pipe came under extreme stress, but it survived it, and it landed in London. Then it took off from London, same sort of thing, extreme stress, landed in Singapore. Then it, on the Qantas service to Sydney, took off 7,000 feet, the pipe ruptured in this very slightly too thin wall, and oil cascaded into the center of the engine, caught fire immediately, because the temperature was something like 1,700 degrees Celsius. This caused the rotor, titanium rotor, to melt, distort, start wobbling, all the turbine blades disengaged from it, and they threw themselves like shrapnel through the engine cowling and into the wing and did all the terrible damage. And that suggests to me that we had 459 souls and all the other people involved in this nearly killed because of an engineering error of 1/10,000th of an inch. And is that not possibly pushing the limits of precision beyond our ability as human beings to manage efficiently? It turns out that several other planes had a similarly too thin oil feed stub pipe. They had to be withdrawn from service. Rolls-Royce had to pay about $80 million in compensation for lost time and replacement engines and so forth. But this wasn't like the Southwest Airlines plane where the fan blades just detached. This was a tiny part that was mismachined, and a lot of people nearly died as a consequence.
Yeah, this, of course, is the penultimate question. It's one that, logically you should save to the end, because as we get more and more, we get our precision, get ever more precise, and we get to the point where there are now billions of transistors on a chip, the chances for error, of course, multiply. And the question is, what is the answer? Do we go like the Luddites, who you talked about in the 19th century, went on strike and violently because they knew that jobs were going to be taken? Or do we say, we got to be the best of both? We have to, on the one hand, recognize that despite the chance for error, the net, if one is a utilitarian, the net benefit to the world of having planes that we can are remarkably reliable and give us the freedom to move, or a car or a solar panel, which because of incredibly small tolerances can maybe make us begin to control global warming. Can we really say, let's stop that and let's focus on hand-whittled birds made out of wood to the artisanry? What are your thoughts on that? Forgive the cliche, horns of the dilemma.
Well, my thought is, it's interesting, because usually when I give a talk on this, and I've only been on this book tour for now 4 days, but invariably someone in the audience will ask, I am an engineering student, where do I go from here? Should I be in constant pursuit of the smaller, the better, the finer, the more precise? Or should I not, he didn't actually say, should I whittle a bird from wood for the rest of my days? And I said, no, of course you must pursue it. Of course you must look into quantum computing and using light as a medium for extreme accuracy and so forth. But just keep your feet on the ground. Don't be completely enamored by and blindsided by this desire for precision. Mm-hmm. Remember that craftsmanship and working in wood and working in with your hands still has some value to it, which is what the Japanese have done. I think they've cracked this intellectual problem rather well. They, for instance, the Japanese government gives awards each year to what they call living national treasures, which are men and women who practice craftsmanship and keep the old crafts alive. So the Japanese government well recognizes that the Japanese economy relies hugely on ultra precision with firms like Canon and Nikon and so forth. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that society as a whole is well served by keeping craftsmanship alive too. So there's that particular chapter where I argued that point, I think the headline is on the need for equipoise. And I think society needs to keep its feet on the ground and realizes that both have value.
Indeed.
I think there's a danger in the West that we give too much credibility and worship to precision and too little to craftsmanship.
On the other hand, you know, maybe it's because I'm here in the Bay Area, and yes, there's a lot of techies, but there's a zillion artists. You know, I've had a lifetime fear of getting cancer, and I know that the answer to cancer is going to come at the subatomic level. It's going to be at those 14 nanometer or 5 nanometer electron microscopes, understanding the mechanism of action between genes and proteins and how they express in cells and how, etc. So, you know, I really do think that we, especially because so many people are not techies, and so it's too easy for them to dismiss the technological thing as a race to the bottom. But I think that ultimately, when you look at even something as basic as the, you know, everybody, rich and poor, almost everybody, has a smartphone. And think of the benefits in our lives that come from being able to access the world through Google in something that fits in our pocket. I am kind of in awe of all that. What's your human reaction to that, Simon Winchester?
Well, I'm totally in awe of it, too. I mean, I use my smartphone with its 4.3 billion transistors in that little chip, the A11 chip. I mean, remember this extraordinary statistic that there are more transistors in the world today than there are leaves on all the trees.
I love that statistic. That's amazing.
It's an extraordinary statistic.
Yeah, it's great. Yes.
We make 13 trillion transistors a day.
Wow.
And without a doubt, I mean, the benefits of that are amazing. I can talk to almost anyone in the world. I can look up any fact I want to in the world. Part of me wants also to remain appreciative of the slower life. I do not want to dismiss the fast life. I do not want to dismiss all the benefits that electronics give me. I'm happy beyond belief, but I don't want to turn my back. And so I deliberately, in my farm in Massachusetts, I keep donkeys.
Mm.
I do some not very good woodwork.
Yeah.
I still do letterpress printing.
Uh-huh.
I keep bees and make honey.
Uh-huh.
It's almost as if, and these are things which I've taken up recently as a personal reaction, in
mm-hmm.
a way,
mm-hmm.
to the efficiencies of Google and reading the New York Times every day on my little device. So part of me says, yes, this is wonderful, but by gosh, I love using my hands. I love tradition. I love craft.
Well, some people's desks are very revelatory of such. Is there anything revelatory about your desk in terms of how you've struck some sort of an accord between technology and, you know, fast life and slow?
There is, in a way. It's not so much on my desk as in my house. Every Sunday morning, I have an important ritual to play. Mm-hmm. I live in the farmhouse, and my desk is in a building about 100 feet away from the main house.
Mm-hmm.
In the house at the moment, there are 7... occasionally 8 clocks.
I know.
They're just ordinary tick-tock clocks.
Right.
And I wind them every Sunday morning, and I also have a barograph, which is a clockwork-powered device which records the previous week's rises and falls in the atmospheric pressure and records it on a piece of paper on a circular drum, and I now have 15 years worth of barograph records showing the various hurricanes and storms that have blown through our farm in those 15 years. So I love the ritual of winding these clocks and adjusting the hands backwards and forwards so that at least for that Sunday, every time they strike the hour, they'll all strike more or less together. Then they start falling out of rate, and by Wednesday or Thursday, their timekeeping is totally haphazard. But I like that. I love, there's a line in Dorothy L. Sayers wrote a book in the 1930s, detective story called Gaudy Night, set in Oxford, where I went to university. And she talks about walking through the streets of Oxford at night and listening to the college clocks striking midnight, all, she says, in friendly disagreement. And I like my clocks in friendly disagreement.
Yes, well, and you know, in a sense, you are in friendly disagreement. Who is you? I should let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Simon Winchester. He's a magician of sorts. He takes the dry and makes them wet. whether it is the Oxford Educational Dictionary, Oxford English Dictionary, as in the case of his famous book, Professor and the Madman, or his literally just released book about the what's seemingly dry profession, engineering. The book is called The Perfectionists by Simon Winchester, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. And now I must turn to you, my dear listeners. If you like listening to Work with Marty Nemco, my interviews as well as my taking your calls in which I try to help you solve your work problems, and you like KLW more broadly, for example, other service programs like Your Legal Rights, especially maybe a tip of the cap to Chuck Finney, who recently passed on. He is, you know, a legend, and the show continues. If you like KLW, you like that it serves the local community. You like the very distinctive public radio flavor, local public radio flavor that KALW brings. Those are all good reasons. This is the only time during my hour where you can kind of vote for one or more of those. For $120, you get a, we are motivated by the intrinsic as well as the extrinsic. Intrinsically, it's the good feeling of being a member of KLW. It's your station, a station of choice for you. It feels cosmic justice. But we also do respond to extrinsics. So, for $120, you will get an autographed copy of my 10th book, just out, the third edition of The Best of Marty Nemco, the best 86 of my... I'm as compulsive as Simon Winchester is in terms of details. My 3,000 articles for your work life, your personal life, and making a difference. So for any of those reasons, and there's a basic membership, which is, I think, $50 or $60, I don't remember, that can get you the handy packet of KLW swag. But for whatever, call whatever you can afford, whatever you feel like. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for your pledging is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can simply go online to kalw.org. That's kalw.org. $120 gets you my book. I think $50 or $60 gets a basic membership. And I like to keep these things short. So let's get to what I really want to do, which is talk to Simon Winchester, the author of The Perfectionists. Let's turn to one more disaster, and then we're going to stop. You describe, and this is a quote from your book, as insouciant carelessness, end quote, as the cause of the Hubble telescope disaster. What happened there?
Well, the Hubble, basically a typical reflecting, or what's called a Cassegrain reflecting telescope, but a very, very big one, which was sent up in the 1990s on board a space shuttle to orbit the Earth a couple of hundred miles above the surface, had a main mirror, which was ground by a company called Perkin Elmer in Connecticut, Danbury, Connecticut. And in the grinding of this thing, which is a gigantic piece of glass made by Corning Glass in New York, they ground it to a certain specific flatness or slight curvature that would enable it to focus the light from the distant stars onto a sensor in the middle. They ground it and made a mistake, a tiny mistake, a 50th of the width of a human hair.
Wow.
But that was enough when they turned the telescope on and all the scientists in Baltimore, where the signals were ultimately sent to, looking at what they called first light, which is the first time they opened the lid of the telescope and let the starlight stream in and be reflected by this mirror. Instead of seeing crisp images of faraway stars, they just saw blurs, and they realized that something terrible had gone on. They did some mathematical calculations and realized that the mirror, a thing that had been precisely ground, had been precisely ground inaccurately, incorrectly ground. And the reasons for that are perhaps a bit too technical to go into tonight, but it was a mistake made by Perkin Elmer. So what to do? They were depressed beyond belief, and of course the press was savage. There were pictures of Mr. Magoo floating up in space, and there was a very real fear.
That's pretty funny, actually.
Money had been spent on this thing that
right.
NASA could go belly up, because
right.
It wasn't long after, of course, the disaster with the Challenger, which had happened mm-hmm. in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
So one man, Jim Crocker, his name was, a NASA engineer, was at a conference in Munich, I think, in Germany, with Europeans, because this was the telescope was involved the European Space Agency as well, was having a shower one day, and the shower, as occurs in many European shower stalls, had the shower head mounted on a vertical steel bar,
mm-hmm.
and the shower could be raised and lowered, and the angle of the shower could be tilted onto your head or whatever part of your body you wanted to soak in warm water. And he realized that an instrument based on that, containing what were effectively contact lenses, could be sent up into space, inserted into the failed Hubble telescope, and just like contact lenses, could make the mirror whole again. And so on a subsequent shuttle flight, this repair equipment was sent up, and lo and behold, after it was bolted onto it, the telescope started to work and has been a workhorse now, the best telescope in space and known to astronomers everywhere in the world, has been flying successfully ever since.
About 30 years now, right?
30 years, exactly. And it's about to be supplanted by an even bigger, even more precise telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope, which is at the moment not far from you at the Northrop Grumman factory down in Long Beach in Los Angeles. And it's been assembled, and it's been tested, and it's cost $8 billion so far. And it's being delayed and delayed and delayed, and there is a real fear that even before it gets off the ground, it's due to be launched now in 2020 from the European Space Agency launching site in Kourou in French Guiana, that it may be delayed into extinction because people are exasperated throwing so much money. But if you think Hubble was precise, the James Webb, with an enormous mirror made out of gold hexagons of beryllium, it is really, really expensive and really complicated, but it will enable us to see to the very beginnings of the universe, far, far more deeper into space than Hubble ever could.
Now, forgive me for sounding, you know, being testimony to the Bay Area stereotype, but there has been long objections to NASA that notwithstanding discoveries that derived from space exploration, like a GPS, which we'll talk about in a minute, that the enormous cause, given the number of people who are starving on Earth, who have diseases on Earth, etc., it seems the ultimate example of elitism and not caring about the people. Is there a good response to that?
The poor will always be with us. I know that's a monstrous thing to say, but I'm afraid it is a fact, and I don't think human endeavor, certainly in fields of science and exploration and travel and poetry and art and all of those things, should ever be held hostage to the needs of people who are impoverished. I know that sounds a horribly cruel Malthusian thing to say, but I'm sorry. I do not think that NASA's budget should be cut and everyone who's impoverished should be given money. I don't think it works like that.
Let's turn to GPS. So, I am one of these people who am in awe of GPS. I bought a Prius a couple of years ago, and I was a cheapskate, and to get the one that came, you know, from the factory was costing me an extra $2,000. So I went on Amazon, and I see that the brand name Garmin, I could buy for $100 the top wonderful GPS system that not only told me where I'm going, but would give me where directions at any point in time and tell me which the traffic is better and when reroute me. Roger Easton was core to developing the GPS. Tell the story about Roger Easton and how GPS indeed occurred.
Well, it goes back, if I can give my own experience, which is pre-GPS. I used to be a geologist.
Right.
And one of my early jobs was to work on an oil rig
in the
North Sea.
Right.
To the east of the United Kingdom. And one of the jobs that fell to the geologist, once you had finished drilling a hole and successfully had capped it off and you went looking for more oil, the people in company headquarters in Chicago would say, we need this rig to be towed to a certain area of the sea, and the legs drop down and the drill bit placed on this dome, this seamount in this particular quadrant. And my job was to tow the rig, thousands and thousands of tons of metal and people and money, to this point on the ocean. And then when the tugs had negotiated it, and using a system called Decca Navigator, which was a precursor of GPS using intersecting radio beams sent from coastal stations, could get a fix and order the tool pusher on the rig to drop the legs. The legs would plummet down onto the seabed and you would start drilling. And when I did it, and I was then a 21-year-old, new from, you know, wet behind the ears graduate from university, I did this whole thing, maneuvered the rig into position using these tugs, ordered them to drop the legs. They dropped them, and the tool pusher came on and said, you've done fine for a newbie, but you're 200 feet off the agreed position. That's all right, he said. We can compensate with our drills. And as it happened, that particular well, my first, they struck gas within 2 weeks, and it was a flowing well, and I think is flowing to this day, so it was a great success. But then I told this story recently to a Japanese friend of mine who's on these survey ships out in the Northwest Pacific, very remote part of the sea. And I said, I was able to tow an oil rig and drop its legs down to within 200 feet of its intended position. How accurately, I said to him, can you now tell with GPS where you are on the surface of the planet, on the surface of the sea? And he said, we interrogate 12 satellites, whereas the average telephone, iPhone that you might have, interrogates 4. We can interrogate 12 satellites, and I can tell my position on the sea to 2 centimeters.
Wow.
So things have changed big time. And the early GPS satellites were based on the Doppler system. When you hear a railway train going past a signal, you hear the ding, 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 ding. The note changes because of the frequency of the sound in your ear is diminishing or increasing, depending whether it's coming towards you or going away from you. Using a similar thing with the passage of satellites above your head, the frequency of signals that they sent out could be, using the Doppler effect, calculated and the distance to them, and could be known very accurately, and you could triangulate with 3 satellites and find out where you were on the surface of the planet to within about 100 feet. This was in the 70s and 80s. And then came this man called Roger Easton, who was a physicist, and said effectively what you need to do is to put a clock, a highly accurate clock, in a satellite and compare its time with the time of a clock down on Earth. And they'll be fractionally different depending on the distance between the two, the satellite and the thing at your telephone or whatever it is at ground level. And then triangulate these distances, and you can tell exactly where your phone is on the surface of the planet. And that was the beginning of the global positioning system, which is now involves 32 satellites, and they're all monitored from a highly secure U.S. Air Force base at a place called Schriever Air Force Base in Colorado, and highly secure because the whole world effectively uses American GPS. There's a Russian GPS system being built. There's a Chinese system being built. There's a European system which has been built but just isn't very good. But the American one has satellites with very accurate clocks, and they've 32 of these satellites, and with a telephone like, or a GPS receiver like the one you have in your Prius, using four of those satellites, you can find your position to within about 5 feet, and that's pretty darn good.
Yeah, as I understand it, that actually we could get it to 5 feet, but for security reasons, because, for example, to protect the president, we don't want people knowing where an individual might be, so the government has capped it at, I think, 150 feet or 50 feet or something like that.
If I can disabuse you of that idea,
good.
Actually, that used to be true.
Oh, okay.
But is no longer true.
Ah.
No, President Clinton abolished that. You're quite right. It used to. They built in an error, which was 200 feet, because they didn't want anyone lobbing a missile into the Oval Office. But now they've said, to heck with it. This is freedom of information. Everyone should have access to it. They need to know exactly where they are on the planet. So, Defense Department, end that objection. And you effectively, there's effectively no error now. And what you see on your car or your iPhone is essentially exactly where you are.
I see. Now, dear listeners, you know, what is the purpose of this? You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Simon Winchester, the author of The Perfectionist, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. We who are not techies, word people like me, and I think Simon, are, until he wrote this book, even though he was a geologist, maybe we take some of this stuff not quite for granted, but we do pay, to use the term he used at the beginning of the show, an homage to these engineers for everything from the telephone to a screw, as we talked about earlier. Let's kind of bring this to its logical conclusion. We got to talk about the computer chip. Now, you wrote that computer chip's power is not as well. We can define it by the billions of transistors on the chip, but really you said something interesting that I didn't realize, that it's more accurate to describe the increased power by the space between the transistors on the chip. And I just took a look in preparation for the show at the current best from Intel and AMD, and the space is now 12 nanometers. What is that? A piece of paper is 100,000 nanometers thick, and the space between transistors in the current best from Intel is 12. How the hell did engineers come up with the first transistor in which a single one was originally the size of a kid's hand, to today's chip in which, like you said, there's 4.3 billion in your iPhone on the size of a fingernail?
Well, the extraordinary thing is that to make these chips, you need machines which are truly gigantic. They're mostly made by a company that most of us have never heard of. They're called ASML, and they're Dutch, and they're in Eindhoven, about 50 miles south of Amsterdam. And these people have perfected, they're the best in the world. There's a small Japanese company which is trying to compete in the field of photolithography, where you actually, it's like an old photo enlarger, where you projected, if in the old days you projected a negative and enlarged it, and then on a sheet of paper, a photosensitive paper, would print an enlarged image of what you've got up in the, as it were, the projector. These do the reverse. They take something enormous and reduce it through reducing lenses. They're not glass lenses, but they are lenses, down to something tiny. And they do that. It's called the technique is called photolithography. And they use this to, an image is put in the top of the machine, an image of a microchip designed by one of the manufacturers like Intel or Apple or whoever makes the chip, and it projects it into a tiny, tiny, tiny space on a big slice of silicon. And that is how they make transistors today. And as we said, 4.3 billion of them, tiny, unimaginably tiny, with, as you say, 12 nanometers distance between each of them. The machine that makes them weighs 160 tons.
Oh, wow.
It requires three jumbo jets to carry it.
Wow.
Intel, when they order them, orders them about 15 at a time and puts them into these gigantic factories, which are in remote locations all over, mainly in the American Southwest. The most recent is called Fab, for fabrication plant, Fab number 42, which is outside Phoenix. And highly secure, you can't go in them, in an incredibly clean environment.
Right.
They have these gigantic ASML machines. lots and lots of very pure, wafer-thin pieces of silicon on which they print these integrated circuits that have these millions, billions of transistors on them. So it's a very clever process, and ASML is under enormous pressure to make even bigger, even better, even more precise machines as our telephones get more and more sophisticated and powerful. And yet you're reaching down to levels of space between the transistors, which is getting down to atomic levels,
right,
where things start, if you know your Heisenberg, start behaving most peculiar, because you're getting down into the quantum level.
A chaos principle, where things are, at some point, is just there's too much noise in the system and you can't be predictive.
Exactly. You know, so is this going to force a limit to electronic precision in the same way that I wonder about limit in mechanical precision, which caused that near accident with the Qantas aircraft?
Right. Simon Winchester, in passing, mentioned the word clean. You have no idea how clean. And again, I didn't know this either until I read his book, The Perfectionist. But it's so, you know, we are breathing what is essentially a chemical, a soup of particles as we breathe. And obviously, if you've got only 12 nanometers, which is at a subatomic level between transistors, even the smallest little of one of these particles is going to create a short in the circuit. So these are cleaned beyond what my wife would do.
And that's saying something, knowing my
wife
right. as well.
Yeah. Anyway, we're coming to conclusion. I want to bring this down away from the technology to something very human. One of the many things that struck me in the book, because you had these little mini biographies of each of these people, is that work-life balance was not exactly a watchword for many of these people. Is that accurate to say that maybe the lesson for all of us is, yeah, if you have the genius of a John Wilkinson or a Henry Maudslay or a Roger Easton, then maybe you should forego work-life balance because there's so much you could contribute, and that work-life balance is for the rest of us mere mortals. Is that a reasonable inference?
Well, quite honestly, the whole work-life balance question is something I've never really thought about, so I can't give... I feel it might be something more discussed in the Bay Area than it is where I work, because I work hard writing my books, but I also keep my feet, I think, fairly firmly on the ground by having this farm and with donkeys and bees and all the rest of it. So I try to balance, but it's all sort of work, I think. And also, if you love what you do, as you evidently do, then it's really not work at all. And I suspect that John Wilkinson and Henry Maudslay and Roger Easton found what they were doing wasn't actually work. It wasn't putting on a gray suit and cashing the 8:15 and going in to work for some financial company every day. What is some people call work, I call pleasure, and certainly everything I do I regard as eminently pleasurable.
You do. I think I want to get one more question then. I do work. I work as, you know, a lot. But I do it more out of a sense of responsibility than fun. If I want to have fun, I will watch a movie with my wife in our little cocoon watching a movie, or we will go out to eat or giggle with friends or listen to music or go to the theater. I do this for a sense of responsibility. Do you actually, as Simon Winchester is working on his next book, do you jump out of bed in the morning saying, oh good, that messy desk that you describe in your book, do you really find it fun, or is it more of a something you do well but is more of a responsibility? What do you really think?
I honestly feel a great enthusiasm every morning that I am learning something from what I'm writing. And I love I'm 74 now, I guess I've got another 10 or 15, 20 years left, the thought that every day I can absorb more knowledge, information, and become a little sort of have an ever enriching life gives me enormous pleasure. So it is, and I don't mean to sound mealy mouthed in saying so. Yes, when I'm doing the editing process, when I'm getting not very nice letters from my editor in New York saying change such and such a paragraph to something else, that becomes a little bit irksome. But the research I love, and the writing process I love, and then the getting the box of finished books and opening them and thinking, my gosh, they've done a good job. The whole process, I absolutely adore it.
All right, I want to pitch the book. This is actually, I rarely do this, but I was moved to write a review of the book on Amazon. And I wrote something like this. I said, the book, The Perfectionist by Simon Winchester, is a book to be savored on one or more levels. Of course, it's a treat for engine nerds who enjoy crystalline explanation of engineering's quantum achievements, but it's also well worth it for readers who enjoy tech made not just accessible, but wrapped in stories well told. It's also fun for those who enjoy luxuriating in the non-essential. And lastly, it's a hell of a writing lesson to aspiring scribblers. So I do commend this book to you, my dear listeners, The Perfectionist by Simon Winchester. You're going to be here in the San Francisco Bay Area next week at the Commonwealth Club. Tell us, pitch that briefly.
Yes, and I think rather a lot more, too. I think I'm there for 4 days.
Okay.
And I've got to do Book Passage. I've got to do, I think it's called Books, Inc. I've got to do some Rake Straw Books, I think it is. And, no, I've got a very full program, so I'm going to have great fun. It's always lovely to come back, and I've got many, many friends, because I lived in San Francisco for many months when I was doing the research for a book on the 1906 earthquake, which was called A Crack in the Edge of the World, which came out in, I think, 2006. So I love it. It'll be super to get back, and after it's now getting hot over here in the east, I'd like a bit of San Francisco cool mist.
Well, you've given us a very cool exploration of the world of the precision engineer, Simon Winchester. Thanks very much for squeezing me into your very busy schedule.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
And we only have a couple minutes left. This, my dear listeners, you know, I would be dishonest if I told you I like this part of what I do, but it is important for me to do it, and frankly, it's important for you to do it. To be a member. I donate, you know, these are my book, Best of Marty Nemco. I donate copies of this book for free because I believe in KALW and public radio. And if you believe in KALW and public radio and you like Work with Marty Nemco, my interviews or my workovers that I do on calls, my career advice, or you like the other service shows on KALW, like Your Legal Rights, which for so long has been wonderful, a great service by Chuck Finney that he's done, he's just passed on, or you just like the zeitgeist, the spirit of KELW. It is quite distinct political tone. The music shows like Joanne Mars, folk music and beyond. If you like KELW, this is your only time to do it. The money to your pledge, $50 or $60, I think it's your basic membership, but I will give you an autographed copy of my brand new 2018, my 10th book, The Best of Marty Nemco, 3rd edition, the best 86 of my 3,000 articles for your work life. And I feel like I'm a little reluctant to do it, but I feel like I should. It's not just, some other people thought it was pretty damn good too. So I'll read just a couple of quotes of people who have reviewed the book. The past president of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapy, Michael Edelstein, wrote it, quote, full of fresh, smart, actionable ideas. Warren Farrell, the author of The Myth of Male Power, said the best of the best. Research scientist Jonathan Y. at Duke University said, quote, incredible ratio of unique ideas per sentence. And you can get that with my autograph, Best of Marty Nemco, and the great feeling of being a participant in KALW, a member in community, local public radio, good radio, radio worth listening to, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or if you prefer to do it online, no problema. KALW.org. It's really easy. It takes just a minute. You can use credit cards. You know, they make it easy to take your money. KALW.org. So we only have a minute left. So, or no, we don't. This is it. This is really it. So whether you have, you, if you've donated during my hour, I am grateful, because every dollar you donate now, and this is the only time, is a vote for Work with Marty Nemco. And especially since I've now moved to this new time, Thursdays at 7, I imagine that I have a much smaller listenership for a while until I build the audience. So every dollar really is a vote for Work with Marty Nemco, and I appreciate it. But even if you don't, if you don't have the money, just want to listen, it is an honor to be serving you. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. My wife, Barbara Nemco, is going to attempt to rip apart that new 3rd edition of my book, Best of Marty Nemco. We'll see if I can defend it or have to agree, in some cases at least, that she's right. In any event, I hope some important career advice will emerge. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. We'll be right back.